Hello, podcast listeners. You are currently listening to Stories Past, stories told to students by me, Blake Smith, over the last 30 years. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Stories Past. It's episode 2 of the series that I'm putting together, and I just like to start by saying how happy I am with the response that episode 1 has gotten. And in fact, many people have let me know that they want to know more things about Connie Cook or more things about my trip to Washington, which I do intend to tell those stories. But today, I'm going to go to perhaps the best story that I ever tell. And you might be saying, how can you start with your best story? Well, I mean, it's my second best story or third, but it's a really good story. And I'm telling it primarily because I just told it yesterday to my advanced placement class, and my son Quinn, who lives in Denver now, texted me and said, when are you going to tell the story about Dwayne? And I said, well, I might as well go ahead and do it now. So this story is a pretty important one for my entire life because a lot of important events happened at a weird place in the middle of Arizona, a place that very few people have been. And a place that my father decided to take his family, my family, all five kids, to the bottom of the Grand Canyon, to an Indian reservation called the Havasupai Indian Reservation. Now, the Havasupai Indian Reservation is an autonomous tribal community that lives down in the canyon along a tributary of the Colorado River called the Havasupai Creek, which we will talk about later. And my father found out about it because he was an avid reader of National Geographic. Now, one of the editions of National Geographic had a very lengthy article about Havasupai, the Indian reservation. And in fact, the title of the article was Indian Shangri-La of the Grand Canyon. And the reason I know that is because our library was disposing of some old National Geographics. You know, everybody says they're National Geographic. And I found in my hand that particular edition of National Geographic. And I've been flipping through it and seeing all these pictures. And it brings back memories of me as a child looking at these pictures, which some kid wrote in, and remembering vividly this particular magazine and looking at the magazine and thinking about going there. Now, the reason that we found out about Havasupai at all was that my father was a professor at Cornell, and he had his summers off, and we had five kids in my family. My eldest brother is Michael, is an attorney in Rochester, has his own business. My sister Meredith is also an attorney. She works for the Federal Trade Commission in Washington. My sister Melanie is an English teacher in Ithaca High School, where I went and grew up. And my brother Ricky is, Rick is a food scientist working in Ithaca as well. And my parents, my dad was a professor, my mom was a science teacher, every 2 years would pick up and take the entire family somewhere. And it was usually being transported in a large 1970s station wagon, usually an 8-cylinder Buick or Pontiac. The one I remember most was brown, and it pulled a pop-up trailer that we would tag along behind and go from place to place. And on this one particular trip, the destination really, the goal was Havasupai Indian Reservation. My father had a map of the United States on the wall, which he had laminated, and he was able to stick pins into that map. And so I always grew up looking at the map of the United States of America with pins in it. And each trip had its own color, and there was the red trip and the black trip and the blue trip, and then they started to fall off because somebody would bump into it or the dogs would knock it down or something. But I believe this might have been the red trip. And so on this particular trip, the destination was Havasupai Indian Reservation. But my father was not only a college professor, but he was a theologian and a Baptist minister. And as a Baptist, baptism takes place for adults. And basically adulthood, or when you can make your own decision. So my father decided he wanted to baptize his family in the place that was the closest to the Jordan River where Jesus was baptized by John. And so of all the places, he thought Grand Canyon. but not only Grand Canyon, but he found this place and he thought it would be ideal for us to be baptized. So this is a great idea. Now, remember that this is a family that is from Ithaca, New York. We're not really backpackers to speak of. And we're going to backpack down into the Grand Canyon in the middle of the summer. And so we go and everybody has their backpacks and we all packed up and we're all ready to go down to have a supai. But when to get there, you have to travel to a place called Peach Springs, Arizona, which is in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of Arizona, and you know, hundreds of miles from what you consider Grand Canyon, or at least a couple hundred. And at Peach Springs, we camped there. And then we turned onto, we left our camper and we turned with our brown Pontiac station wagon onto a road. And this road, believe it or not, was the road to what is called Hualapai Hilltop, which is simply a parking lot. And as we turned onto this road, the road had grass in the middle of it. It was a dirt road. And my father and the rest of my family drove 40 miles on that road. And I don't remember specifically just worrying about it or anything like that, but it, 40 miles, I think about that all the way. So we drove on this kind of grass in the middle of the road and you never see any cars and you finally get to Hualapai Hilltop where you get out. And I'm a kid, I'm probably 11 or 12, 13 maybe. And so I don't remember totally everything, but I do remember that they packed us up and we all got out of our out of the car and we packed our backpacks off and off we went. And it was extremely hot. And we had packed water, but my mom was kind of the one that made sure everybody was taken care of, especially my brother Rick, who was younger, and she was kind of watching out for me and Rick and making sure that we were taken care of. And so off we go. And the trail, you take off from a parking lot and you take off and you start dropping immediately down a switchback trail. And the trail is full of kind of a red dust that kind of puffs as you step into it, as you walk down the trail. So off we go down the trail and it's pretty warm, but it starts to heat up and the day gets hotter and hotter. And as you enter into these canyons, this red rock just acts as an oven and it catches the heat and it makes it hotter and hotter and hotter, just almost unbearably hot. And it is a 10-mile hike from Hualapai Hilltop to the village. And so we're moving along and things didn't seem to be bad to me. I was having a good time. And then it started to seem like we were kind of not getting there. And where are we ever going to get there? And at some point my mother passes out. So my mom, who is a science teacher, high school science teacher, now she's down, and she's passed out and you're in the middle of this place. There's no real place to find shade. You have to kind of like push them up against the wall, And so we're kids, we're freaked out. And my father goes, go ahead and try to go find water. So my brother and I take off, or brothers, I can't remember. We all took off running and we ran ahead. Now remember, it's really, really hot. We have no water left because we're kind of done with the water. We've used it all. And luckily we only ran for maybe a half mile, maybe 3/4 of a mile. And sure enough, there is the stream, the Havasupai Creek. And we come to the creek. I can remember specifically dropping the canteens, filling them up, closing them and running as fast as we can back to my mother. And by the time we got there, my mama still was not really with it. She was kind of woozy and wasn't really conscious. And so we gave her, had her drink some water. We poured water on her. And we actually, if I remember correctly, we carried her kind of on our shoulders, like the old firemen carry, all the way back to that water. So about 3/4 mile, we carry her, we place her down into the river, and like magic, she comes back to life. And of course, that's why it's interesting, because it was almost a baptismal for real in terms of a rebirth. And my mom comes back and she was fine the rest of the trip, although my father did hire a horse to get her out. And that is a story my mom told many times, but for another time. So we go on down, we go down to the Grand Canyon. My mom is fine. The village is interesting, maybe couple hundred people down there. They have a hotel. There was a restaurant. We had these things called Indian tacos. I remember they called them, which was basically a tortilla with like lettuce and tomato, but it was really good because you're starving because there's not much food. And there's a campground and my dad baptized our whole family at the campground and in these waters, which are just stunning. Now, we should probably go back to the water thing. The Havasupai means people of the blue-green water. And in some strange geologic magic, out of the cliff, somewhere up in Grand Canyon, comes gushing this water. And the water comes out of the cliff. And I wish I could go to the headwaters of wherever it starts. But the water comes down, and it comes out, and it's really cold, relatively cold. And it comes down, and the water is blue-green. And it kind of reminds you of what you would think Hawaii water is like, or what the Caribbean, that blue, kind of that, you can't quite describe it, marble kind of blue. And it is just amazing. And if you get a chance, just go ahead and Google right now, go Google Havasupai, and up it comes, and you know what I'm talking about. And what was really interesting about that particular place is that the water, the Havasupai waters, it actually, the reason it's colored that way is because there's minerals in it. So the high levels of minerals would float down, and it caused it to grow. So the stone would grow. It wouldn't wear down. In most cases, water wears down mountains, wears down the creek. This grew rock. And so as the water poured over the top of whatever it was, it would leave behind what they call travertine, and travertine would grow. And so what you had down in the bottom were waterfalls where water was pouring, this beautiful blue water. And then all around it are these giant kind of gargoyle-like frozen stone waterfalls that have been caused by water pouring over them all these years. And below that, at the creek, just like in Ithaca, where I grew up in the Cascadilla Creek or the Fall Creek, the water would tumble down waterfalls. But in this particular place, it tumbled from a deep pool to a deep pool to a deep pool, because the water was creating a wall. As the wall grew and got bigger and bigger, the pool became deeper and deeper. It's hard for me to even describe what this is. But it was an amazing kind of magic place. And interestingly enough, my dad never really took us to the big waterfalls down below, Mooney and actually Havasu Falls. I don't think we ever saw that, or Supai Falls. But we saw many of the falls, but we didn't see the monstrous ones. And the hike down there is quite unbelievable. You have to go through tunnels, and there's cables and stairs, and because it's difficult. So that story kind of ends with my father having baptized the whole family, and it was a great experience for us, and it became an important place in my life. And it was so important place in my life that when I graduated from college, my friend Todd Warren and I took off, and we went across country and went back there and met my friend Mike Best, and we all hiked down and redid the Grand Canyon trip down to Havasupai, and we camped and we did the whole story. And actually, that's when I learned that as a child, I really hadn't gone down far enough. As a child, by the way, I want to tell you a quick story. We had bumped into Native Americans who lived down there, the Havasupai, and we were playing with Havasupai kids. I can remember playing these kids who were pretty amazing at doing things like riding horses and shooting. But one of the kids wanted to show me that when you swim in, because of the way the waterfall is, you could swim down underneath the waterfall and end up in this cave area. And so this Native American Havasu kid comes to me and he says, "Hey, come on, I'll show you." So we're swimming and everybody's kind of hanging out. And he goes, "Come on, go with me." And I drop down underwater and I drop underneath the waterfall, and I went under this beautiful cave. It was really cool. I was a kid. I was like, you know, it's almost like Tom Sawyer, you know, I'm underneath it and checking it out. And I'm like, "Thanks a lot." And we swim back out underneath the waterfall. The only problem was my mother didn't know where I had gone. And so she thought I was drowned. And so I didn't do that again unless I told her. So as an adult, now I'm graduate from college, I go and I do the Havasupai thing one more time. Now, when I started working in Canajoharie teaching here, I was dating my wife, current wife, Kim Smith. And what we decided to do was, she was from Amsterdam, New York. She really hadn't seen much of this country, and she certainly hadn't seen national parks too much. And so I was going to take her, and we had done some hiking, and we're going to go across country. And so we're all excited to go across country. And we packed up her brand new Honda LXI Accord, we were so proud of that car with the sunroof and all the good stuff. And we took off and we went across the country and we stopped at different places. And ultimately we ended up at the Grand Canyon. Now, my plan to take my wife, Kim, was not my wife at the time, it was just a friend, girlfriend, was to go to the Grand Canyon and go to the South Rim. And the South Rim is kind of the Brady Bunch place where you go, and it's very beautiful, but there's where all the people are and the hotels and lots of stuff. It's a great view and everybody should do it. But I wanted to take her there first. And my plan was, which was my genius plan, was that since I had done it twice before and it's so hot and this is the summertime, I know what we'll do. We'll go down at night. It'll be a genius idea. I think I checked and the moon was going to be out and we're going to have flashlights and we're just going to walk down at night and it'll be a lot cooler and it'll be easier. And we're camping anyway, so we'll just go do that. So that was my idea. So take Kim to the regular Grand Canyon for the day, and we did a little thing, took our picture and all the stuff you do at the Grand Canyon, and then we left to go to Havasupai. Now, you have to get to Havasupai, you have to leave the Grand Canyon, go south for 60 miles, get on the highway, drive to Peach Springs. And then you have to get on that road I talked about where my father drove 40 miles on a road with grass in the middle of it. Dirt roads, 40 miles. And so when I took Kim to this particular spot and we're in the Honda LXI, we pull onto it and we cross over what's called a cattle guard. And we look and there's this beautiful highway. And it's a wonderful black topped perfect highway. And off we went. I think when Todd and I went years before, it probably was better, but this was a beautiful highway. So we turn onto it. And remember, this is a road that leads to nowhere but Hualapai Hilltop, where you park your car and you hike down to the Havasupai Industry. There's nothing between there. There's a couple houses, a silo here and there, but maybe some cows, but they're going to go 40 miles. So we turn onto it. Now, remember, it is now dark. And because it is now dark, we're passing, well, it's not quite dark, but the sun is setting. So we're heading on this road. We're in the desert. Now, all around us are cactus and it's dry and it's brown and you're driving. And I got this nice car and the sun begins to set. It's kind of beautiful. We're checking it out and I'm thinking, still have my plan going. And the only problem was as the sun sets, when you are a car and you have your lights on, everything wants to come to you. So bugs and animals and all sorts of things. It seems like they're all coming to our car. And we're driving along and I'm whacking into bugs and very large moths and things like that. And then all of a sudden there were the jackrabbits. And the jackrabbits running off in front of the car and I'm swerving, trying not to hit them. And then there was this thing, I think it was called a nighthawk or something. It was like a giant swallow. And they were diving at my car. You know, they were diving at my car and diving and diving. And finally one of them hit my windshield. Burst of feathers in my face. And Kim is like, what is going on? Where are we going? Why are you taking me? And I was like, crazy. It just seemed very, very unnerving. And we're driving. So usually what I thought was, or what I thought the best decision to make was to go faster. Because if I went faster, I could just get to Hualapai Hilltop faster, that all this trip would be over. So I just kind of picked up speed. So remember that you're traveling on in the desert, but to get to the Grand Canyon, many people don't know this, the Grand Canyon actually is quite high. So to get to the Grand Canyon, you have to kind of climb up like you're climbing into mountains to get to the Grand Canyon to look down into it. They describe it as like a cake being pushed up through the knife. And so you kind of drive up, and as I'm coming out of the desert, I'm kind of going about 75, 80 miles an hour, and I'm going toward it, and soon the climate starts to change, and the temperate zone starts to change from desert to something else. And in front of me is this big ponderosa pine forest with pine trees straight up and down that are probably, you know, 30, 40 feet tall. So I'm coming in to do about 80. And I come in, and as I turn to go into this forest, I look up and there's this herd of elk. They're standing in this particular area. And I don't know, there's probably 30. Maybe I'm exaggerating, but there's a lot of elk standing in the middle of the road. And I can't really stop in time not to hit them. So I start pumping the brakes. I'm pumping the brakes, and all the elk take off running, and the elk scatter in all directions, except for the bull elk, except for the elk that was in charge of this entire menagerie, this entire entourage of elk with him. And so his group of elk take off, but he is trying to defend all his female elk. And so he's going to take my car on. So he starts running alongside my car. And I'm braking, swerving, turning, and he is running full bore alongside my car. But he's not running on my side of the car. He's running on Kim's side of the car. And for that reason, she is looking at a snot-throwing, angry buck elk with a giant rack running alongside. And she is just like, you know, scared to death and kind of, you know, looking out the window at this thing. So I'm able to maneuver the car. I don't hit anything. The elk takes off to runs to defend the rest of his herd. At this point, Kim turns to me and she goes, you've got to be out of your mind. She goes, you're not going to drive over the speed of 35 the rest of the way. And I said, all right, I'll slow down. So I kind of putzed along the rest of the way. And remember, it's 40 miles. It's a nice road. But at this point, I'm just going to get there. Well, by this point in this journey, in my mind, I'm like, I am never going to take her down into Havasupai in the nighttime. It's a bad idea to begin with. And it's certainly a bad idea after what we just went through. So we drive up and we make that decision. I said, Kim, we'll just spend the night in the car. We'll park the car. We'll sleep in the car and we'll wake up real early. We'll put our backpacks on and then we will go on down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon. It'll be perfect. We'll start early. It won't be that hot because the sun had rise and we won't have to worry about this down through the night thing. We'll just kind of stay there. So that'll work out just fine. So we pull into this parking lot. Now you have to imagine a parking lot that sits up high and all around you is beautiful red rocks, but also there's nowhere else to go. And at this place is nothing more than a parking lot, a outhouse bathroom, a heliport, and a place to tie horses to, and then the beginning of the trail. And as we pull in, there are probably maybe 30 cars in the parking lot, but there's no people there. So everyone has either come and left or they've already gone down. So there's no other people there. And it's pretty late. It's probably 10:30 or 11 o'clock. So I get there and we decide that we're going to get out, and Kim is kind of nervous still, and she's looking off the edge of this thing. She said, "We're going down in there." And I said, "Yeah, don't worry. It looks a lot better in the daytime." And you're going, I said, "Don't worry. It's really good." And so I'm kind of distracting her, and we're working on our packs and stuff. And we decide we're going to kind of go to sleep. But just about that time, we hear that there's somebody coming out of the canyon. And I'm like, that's kind of weird, coming out of the canyon this late at night. So she and I walk over. We go to where the canyon kind of the trail ends up on into the parking lot. And we look and we walk up, and there's a man holding hands with a little boy who's 5 or 6 years old. And he yells at the top of his lungs, "Thank God I'm out of that hellhole." And as he walks up, I walked up to him and I said, "What are you doing?" And he goes, "We walked down into the village this morning, and we thought that we could get a horse to come back out, but they wouldn't rent us a horse, and we couldn't get." I looked at the guy. I said, "You walked down to have a soup pie today and you walked back?" He said, "Yeah, I did." And he had a child on his hand, which was like probably child abuse. And then behind him is his wife who's dragging herself up the thing too. I'm talking about 10:30 at night. So they've been walking basically all day. It's 10 miles down, 10 miles back. Well, this did not comfort Kim much. Hellhole didn't really make her very that confident. So they take off, they get in the car, and off they go. So we're sitting there and we kind of trying to sleep. It's really uncomfortable and there's bugs and we can't have the dome light on, you know, all those kind of problems that go with it. And we didn't want to run the air conditioning, la, la, la. So we're kind of hanging out. And then all of a sudden it's maybe 12:30 at night and we hear a clip, clop coming out of the canyon, And out of the canyon comes a man on horseback with other horses tied behind him, which is pretty normal for this particular area. One guy leads them and the other ones kind of pull along that would carry stuff. And he comes to the top of the canyon and he gets out at the parking lot. He ties his horse to a horse, what you tie a horse to, and his other horses, and he's kind of standing there. And so Kim's like, "What do you think he's doing?" I said, "I don't know what he's doing." I said, "Well, let's just kind of keep doing what we're doing." So it's about 11:30, maybe 11:15 at night. And so I'm trying to distract her. So I decide we're going to fit her for her pack. So Kim puts on her pack, probably hadn't had this pack on before, and I'm adjusting the straps and everything, make sure it fits right and it's all properly balanced. And as I'm doing this, from behind her, as I'm fitting the pack, that gentleman starts walking toward us. So no one in the parking lot, the two of us, some guy on horseback walking toward me. And now Miss Kim doesn't see the person walking toward me. She only sees me. And so I'm fixing her pack and everything. And suddenly there's these dogs running around, dogs running, and dogs that are gray and brown and black and mixed and mottled and strange ears and strange tails and running around. And the man walks up maybe 10, 15 feet behind Kim and yells at the top of his lungs, "Suma!" Kim was so scared that she really, I always describe it, she kind of jumped into my shirt. Like she couldn't have really been more scared. She really couldn't have been. And she was so frightened and so just startled by this event. And I look at the man and he looks back at me and he says, "Did I frighten you?" And I was like, "Yeah." And it turns out that Suma means dog. So from then on, whenever you yelled Suma, every dog would turn their head. I used to do it quite often. Suma, heads would turn. But we still have now this new man, me, and a very scared Kim. The man turns out to be a Havasupai native from down in the canyon, living in the village. And he had come up on his horseback and he turns to me and he says, "My name is Dwayne. What is your name?" And I looked at Dwayne and remember the situation, 11:30 at night. I'm 40 miles from Peach Springs, which is 300 miles from Phoenix, whatever. So I'm on his reservation. He says, "My name is Dwayne. What is your name?" And of course I said, "My name is Blake." Well, that might've been a mistake, because if Dwayne in the next 3 hours or 2.5 hours or 2 hours, whatever it was, didn't say Blake 500 times, he might've said 700 times, because from that point onward, he said Blake, Blake, Blake to me all the time. And this person, Dwayne, proceeds to tell me his entire life story, his love life and everything. He played for a basketball team on and on. And it was really outrageous. And Kim keeps turning to me like, "Who is this guy? What's going on?" And he had been drinking. So he was a little bit drunk. He actually asked me if I had any beer. I said, "No," I gave him a pear, I think, if I remember correctly. we talked and talked and talked. He talked to me all night. And the whole time I'm kind of talking to him, kind of trying to get him to go away because I knew that Kim wasn't comfortable with it. And he was just kind of annoying, to be honest with you. And so Dwayne keeps talking to us. And at one point we decide, oh, I know, we'll go into the car and we'll roll up the windows and we'll pretend we're sleeping. Tell him we're going to bed now, Dwayne. And so we did that. So the two of us, we get into the car. We close the windows very uncomfortably. We turn off the dome light. We sit there. We pretend we're sleeping. Dwayne proceeds to walk over to his horse, take a blanket off that horse, and lay the blanket down right behind our Honda LXI Accord, at which time he lays down to go to sleep. And Kim looks at me and she's like, what is he doing? Why is he doing that? I said, I don't know. It's his reservation. What are you? I don't know. And we're sitting there talking, and all of a sudden I see his face. And he comes to my window and he knocks on the window and I start the car. I roll the window down and he looks at me and says, Blake, don't back up. At which point I raised the window. I looked at Kim and we could not sleep anymore. So we got out of the car. We stood there. He didn't lay down anymore. He got up too. We're hanging out together, talking some more. And suddenly, from out of nowhere, a truck shows up. A pickup truck comes from nowhere. We hadn't seen a car in hours. Well, hour and a half. Car shows up. Dwayne does the kind of like hide behind the car thing where he drives down, you know, hides behind my car so they don't see him. And I'm like, Dwayne, by this point, don't forget, I'm totally great friends with him by now. I talk to him all the time. I can criticize him. We're pals. All right. I heard his whole life story, including, by the way, don't forget, he just got broken up with a girl. So he's hiding and then he looks over there and he goes, Blake, I'll be right back. And so he walks off like I cared, but he walks off to go and to talk to this person in the pickup truck. So I'm thinking to myself, good. So finally he's gone. I think this is time we can be done with him. So he goes over and I see him talking to the guy in the pickup truck. And there he goes to the pickup truck and he goes to the back of the pickup and he reaches out and he's got 12 packs of Budweiser. And he's weighing 12 pack of Budweiser into the saddlebags of his horse, 12 packs of, and he had maybe 15, 20 of them. And I was like, oh my God, Dwayne is a bootlegger. Dwayne, see, alcohol is illegal on the reservation. I could buy alcohol in downtown, Havasupai. I swear to God, I can walk into the store and buy a beer, but the Indians couldn't. The Native Americans could not. And for that reason, he was a bootlegger and he would sneak it in at night. So he's putting all this beer and I finally figured out that's what he's doing. So he's putting in it. And then at the same time, out of the truck is a woman. Woman gets out of the truck. The truck drives away. The woman is standing there. He's got maybe six horses loaded with Budweiser. And he walks up to me and goes, Blake, I'm a happy man. I found a woman. And he said goodbye and took off. And I never, ever saw Dwayne again. We never, Kim and I never saw Dwayne again. And he disappeared. When the next morning, we'll get up and Kim and I will hike down doing the hike. And I asked another Havasupai person and I asked him, I said, do you know Dwayne? And the guy goes, was he drunk? That was his response to me. And I never asked about Dwayne again. He didn't seem to be a very popular member of the community, but a very interesting story. But the story's not over because Kim and I now hike down to the Grand Canyon and we start hiking down and immediately you drop off like a cliff and you kind of do switchbacks down into the canyon. And we go down into the canyon and Kim's like, you have to hike back up through this thing? I said, yeah, don't worry. And she goes, starts complaining. I said, it's really early to be complaining. And she turns to me, she goes, look, I'm telling you right now, when I come back and I'm going up this hill, I'm complaining. I said, okay, dear, you can complain. Go ahead. It's fine. So off we go and we go down to the Grand Canyon. We have a wonderful time. Just awesome time, great experience, no problems whatsoever. And now it is time to return. And in fact, Kim and my experience down in the Grand Canyon was just a wonderful experience. Great pictures, just a great trip. And so we're hiking back out and we're hiking out and it's tough. And you're hiking and you're walking in this dust and it's hot and it's sweaty and it's gross and you're hiking. And so finally we get to that cliff and Kim starts complaining. She starts complaining. I said, come on, Kim, don't complain. She goes, I told you I was going to complain. So I said, all right. So she complains a little bit. So we start to go up the switchbacks and we're heading toward the top of the parking lot. And at the very end, I kind of leave her a little. I leave her behind just a little bit. And as I leave her behind, I go to the top of the hill and I turn and watch her. And here she is with her backpack, with her long hair covered in red dust and sweat dripping off her nose. And I propose to her right there in Hualapai Hilltop. And Kim turned to me and she said, you're going to ask me here? Not a very good imitation of Kim, but that's the best I got right now. And I said, yes. And so she said, yes. We turned around. There was this huge busload of people about to go back down, and they had this giant cooler full of ice. And we had drank nothing but lukewarm water the whole time. And I walked up without accepting an answer. And I said, can I have one of these? And I took a Yoo-hoo, two of them. Kim and I broke Yoo-hoo open, and we toasted our wedding, or our future wedding, toasted our engagement with Yoo-hoo. And so Yoo-hoo has a special place in my heart, although I don't drink it that often. And a few hours later, Kim and I were in Las Vegas, Nevada, where we had lots of nice things as opposed to lukewarm water. And so everybody, that is the story of Havasupai. And I hope you enjoyed it.